Welcome to this week's Ortho Digest Rundown for June 8, 2026. This week we indexed 462 new orthopedic studies across 34 journals. The 75 highest impact studies are featured on the site, and we're covering the top 25 studies in this audio digest. As always, studies are ranked by our impact algorithm, which weighs journal tier and level of evidence. Let's start with our first study. Reisner and colleagues published in Clinical Orthopedics and Related Research, titled, Do Perineural Dexamethasone and Dexmedetomidine Improve Analgesia and Inflammatory Response After Lumbar Spine Surgery? This triple-blinded randomized controlled trial compared ropivacaine-only erector spinae plane block versus ropivacaine plus dexamethasone versus ropivacaine plus dexmedetomidine in 90 adults undergoing posterior lumbar decompression with instrumented fusion. Dexmedetomidine delayed first rescue opioid by 9.6 hours, with a 95% confidence interval of 8.5 to 10.5 hours, and dexamethasone delayed it by 6.6 hours, with a 95% confidence interval of 5.6 to 7.7 hours, compared to control. Dexamethasone uniquely attenuated postoperative neutrophil to lymphocyte ratio, platelet to lymphocyte ratio, and systemic immune inflammation index relative to both other groups. One limitation to note is that follow-up was limited to 48 hours, which prevents assessment of whether differential early opioid consumption translates to reduced opioid dependence or chronic postoperative pain at clinically meaningful time points. Overall, dexmedetomidine added to erector spinae plane block extended time to first rescue opioid by 9.6 hours, compared to ropivacaine alone, while dexamethasone produced greater attenuation of systemic inflammatory indices in lumbar fusion patients. Moving on, Farouk and colleagues published in the Journal of Arthroplasty, titled The Impact of Photographic Evidence on Postoperative Range of Motion Following Total Knee Arthroplasty, a Randomized Control Trial. This randomized controlled trial tested whether providing total knee arthroplasty patients with intraoperative photographs of their knee in maximum flexion and extension would improve postoperative range of motion and rehabilitation outcomes. 27 patients received photographs and 28 did not, with primary outcome being 6-week knee flexion. The photograph group achieved significantly better extension at 0 degrees versus 3 degrees in the control group, but showed no significant differences in flexion at 118 degrees versus 115 degrees, physical therapy duration, sessions, ambulation distance, or knee injury and osteoarthritis outcome score. One limitation to note is that the sample size of 55 patients is underpowered to detect clinically meaningful differences in secondary outcomes, and the 6-week endpoint captures only early rehabilitation. Overall, providing postoperative range of motion photographs to total knee arthroplasty patients improved knee extension by 3 degrees at 6 weeks, but produced no clinically meaningful differences in flexion, physical therapy metrics, or knee injury and osteoarthritis outcome score. Moving on, Cronay and colleagues published in the American Journal of Sports Medicine, titled Patient Reported Knee Function and Return to Sport Rates After Non-Surgical and Surgical Treatment of an Acute Anterior Cruciate Ligament Injury, results from the NACOX Prospective Cohort Study. The NACOX Multicenter Cohort compared patient-reported knee function using the International Knee Documentation Committee scale and return to sport rates between non-anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction and anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction treatment groups over 24 months, using shared decision-making allocation. Despite the anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction group being younger at 24.2 versus 27.6 years, with higher pre-injury Tegner levels at 8 versus 6.5, linear mixed effects modeling found no between-group difference in International Knee Documentation Committee scale scores at any time point. Overall return to sport was 75% with no group difference, but non-anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction patients returned faster at 3.5 versus 8.1 months, and anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction was associated with 3.15 times higher risk of not returning to sport in the 26 to 40 age subgroup. One limitation to note is that non-randomized treatment allocation with significant baseline differences in age and pre-injury activity level between groups means residual confounding cannot be excluded. Overall, at 24 months, non-anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction and anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction groups achieved equivalent International Knee Documentation Committee scales scores and comparable return to sport rates at 72% versus 77%. But patients aged 26 to 40 years undergoing anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction had a 3.15-fold higher risk of not returning to sport versus non-surgical management. Moving on, Liu and colleagues published in Clinical Orthopedics and Related Research, titled Preoperative Shoulder Stiffness Was Accompanied by Distinct Supraspinatus Tendon Inflammatory Signatures, but Not Inferior Long-Term Outcomes After Rotator Cuff Repair. This prospective observational cohort compared clinical outcomes and intraoperative supraspinatus tendon biology between patients with and without preoperative shoulder stiffness undergoing arthroscopic repair of medium-sized full-thickness supraspinatus tears of 3 cm or less. Stiff patients achieved minimal clinically important difference at higher rates at 3, 6, 12, and 24 months across constant Mirrlee score, Oxford shoulder score, and visual analog score for movement. But longitudinal trajectory differences disappeared after adjustment for baseline score. Tendon RNA sequencing revealed stiff patients were enriched in an inflammatory tendinopathy subtype with a normalized enrichment score of 2.6 and greater immune cell infiltration, while non-stiff patients were enriched in a hypoxia white subtype with a normalized enrichment score of -2.8. One limitation to note is that strict exclusion of tears greater than 3 cm, symptom duration greater than 12 months, and metabolic comorbidities limits applicability to the broader rotator cuff repair population. Overall, in medium-sized full-thickness supraspinatus tears, the study provides valuable insight into the biological mechanisms and clinical outcomes associated with preoperative shoulder stiffness. Preoperative shoulder stiffness did not produce worse 24-month outcomes versus non-stiff shoulders, with 100% versus 83% of stiff patients achieving constant Mirrlee score minimal clinically important difference at final follow-up. Despite distinct inflammatory tendon transcriptomic signatures enriched in inflammatory tendinopathy subtype. Moving on. Kitagawa and colleagues published in Spine Journal, titled Network-Based Analysis of Health-Related Quality of Life Following Surgery for Degenerative Cervical Myopathy. This study applied Gaussian graphical models to SF-36 quality of life score data from 849 degenerative cervical myopathy surgical patients across 10 Japanese centers to map how health-related quality of life domain interdependencies change after surgery. Network structure differed significantly between pre- and postoperative states at the domain level, but global network strength was unchanged, indicating structural reconfiguration rather than global connectivity gain. Role physical was the highest centrality domain preoperatively and increased further postoperatively. Non-responders by Japanese Orthopedic Association criteria additionally showed rising centrality of general health. One limitation to note is that the study population is exclusively from high-volume Japanese centers, limiting generalizability to Western degenerative cervical myopathy populations. Overall, in 849 degenerative cervical myopathy surgical patients, network analysis revealed that surgery reorganizes SF-36 quality of life score domain interdependencies rather than uniformly strengthening them, with role physical emerging as the most central health-related quality of life domain, both pre- and postoperatively. Moving on. Coleman and colleagues published in the American Journal of Sports Medicine, titled Incomplete Restoration of Coracoclavicular Ligament Thickness After Surgical Treatment of Rockwood Type 5 Acromioclavicular Dislocations, a Contralateral Controlled MRI Study with Functional Outcomes. This contralateral controlled MRI study evaluated coracoclavicular ligament morphology and functional outcomes in 46 patients, 28 treated with hook plate and 18 with endobutton, after surgical fixation of Rockwood type 5 acromioclavicular dislocations. Operated shoulders demonstrated persistently reduced trapezoid and total coracoclavicular ligament thickness versus the contralateral control side, while conoid thickness was comparable. Neither technique restored complete ligament morphology. Despite this, functional scores including visual analog score, constant, UCLA, and QuickDash were favorable across both groups, with no clinically meaningful between-group differences, and ligament thickness parameters showed no correlation with patient-reported outcomes. One limitation to note is that the sample size of 46 patients with unequal group allocation limits statistical power. Overall, after surgical repair of Rockwood type 5 acromioclavicular dislocations, trapezoid ligament thickness remains reduced compared to the contralateral side, regardless of fixation technique. Yet functional outcome scores are favorable, and ligament thickness does not correlate with patient-reported outcomes. Moving on, Xu and colleagues published in the Journal of Arthroplasty, titled Central Sensitization Elevates the Minimal Clinically Important Difference of Brief Pain Inventory Scores After Total Knee Arthroplasty. This study asked whether preoperative central sensitization status determined by the central sensitization inventory alters the minimal clinically important difference of the brief pain inventory after primary total knee arthroplasty. In 296 prospectively enrolled patients, anchor-based minimal clinically important differences for total brief pain inventory score were 15.3 points with a 95% confidence interval of 10.65 to 20.03 in the central sensitization group, versus 9.8 points with a 95% confidence interval of 5.82 to 13.94 in the non-central sensitization group, with receiver operating characteristic derived cutoffs of 14.5 and 10.6 respectively. Central sensitization patients achieved clinically meaningful pain relief at significantly lower rates than non-central sensitization patients. One limitation to note is that the central sensitization inventory is a self-report screening tool, not a neurophysiologic diagnosis. So central sensitization group classification may include patients with other pain amplifying conditions. Overall, central sensitization raises the anchor-based brief pain inventory minimal clinically important difference threshold from 9.8 to 15.3 points after total knee arthroplasty, and central sensitization patients are significantly less likely to achieve that threshold at 1 year. Moving on, Schaefer and colleagues published in the British Journal of Surgery, titled Femoral Nerve Palsy in Brace Treatment for Developmental Dysplasia of the Hip: Incidence and Outcomes in a Prospective International Cohort. This multinational prospective study examined risk factors for femoral nerve palsy in children with developmental dysplasia of the hip, treated primarily with orthosis. Mixed effects logistic regression identified Pavlik harness use, lower femoral head percent cover with an odds ratio of 0.87 and 95% confidence interval of 0.84 to 0.91, and lower alpha angle with an odds ratio of 0.82 and 95% confidence interval of 0.76 to 0.89 as independent predictors of femoral nerve palsy. Palsy developed at a median of 7 days post-brace application, with an overall incidence of 3.1% per child and 2.0% per hip. One limitation to note is that functional outcomes and resolution rates of femoral nerve palsy episodes are not reported. Overall, femoral nerve palsy occurred in 3.1% of children treated with orthosis for developmental dysplasia of the hip, with Pavlik harness use at 84.0% versus 61.9%. Lower femoral head percent cover and lower alpha angle identified as independent risk factors. Moving on, Subramanian and colleagues published in the Journal of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, titled Systematic Review of Wound Complications After Direct Anterior Approach Total Hip Arthroplasty: Incidence, Risk Factors, and Management Strategies. This systematic review characterized wound complication incidence, risk factors, and management strategies following primary direct anterior approach total hip arthroplasty across 36 studies and 35,300 hips. The most frequent complications were superficial dehiscence or drainage at 1.41%, superficial surgical site infection at 1.34%, delayed healing at 1.15%, and hematoma or seroma at 0.80%, with obesity and female sex as the dominant risk factors. Meta-analysis demonstrated that transverse incisions conferred significantly lower wound complication risk than longitudinal incisions, with a relative risk of 0.45, and most complications resolved with conservative local wound care. One limitation to note is that inconsistent wound complication definitions across the 36 included studies introduce significant heterogeneity. Overall, transverse bikini incisions reduce wound complication risk by 55% compared to longitudinal incisions in direct anterior approach total hip arthroplasty, with a relative risk of 0.45 and 95% confidence interval of 0.23 to 0.89 across 35,300 cases. Moving on, Munn and colleagues published in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery titled Drivers of Labor and Supply Cost Variation in Anterior Cruciate Ligament Reconstruction, a multicenter, time-driven, activity-based costing analysis. This multicenter, time-driven, activity-based costing analysis quantified supply and labor cost drivers across 861 anterior cruciate ligament reconstructions at 8 hospitals. Supply costs comprised 58.2% of total costs, with a 3.2-fold variation in supply costs spanning a $2,950 range, and 1.6-fold variation in labor costs spanning a $940 range between the 10th and 90th percentiles. Mixed effects modeling identified graft type, primary versus revision status, and concomitant meniscal repair as the dominant modifiable cost drivers, with a conditional R-squared of 0.84 and marginal R-squared of 0.27, with allograft consistently generating higher total and implant costs than any autograft type. One limitation to note is that the marginal R-squared of 0.27 indicates that fixed patient-level factors explain only 27% of cost variation independently of surgeon and hospital clustering, meaning institutional culture and surgeon habit dominate costs. Overall, graft type, surgeon, and surgery center explain 84% of total cost variation in anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction, with a 3.2-fold supply cost difference between the 10th and 90th percentiles across 8 hospitals. Esper and colleagues published in the Journal of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, titled, Can Computed Tomography Hounsfield Units Predict Distal Humerus Fracture Mechanical Complications? This study asked whether CT Hounsfield unit values at the distal humerus metaphysis predict postoperative mechanical complications, including implant failure, non-union, and periprosthetic fracture after both column distal humerus open reduction and internal fixation. Hounsfield units were measured approximately 1 cm from the articular surface in 3 planes on preoperative CT in 153 patients. Coronal Hounsfield units were significantly lower in the complication group, and logistic regression confirmed coronal Hounsfield units with an ABODS ratio of 0.973 and current smoking with an odds ratio of 1.102 as independent predictors of mechanical complications. One limitation to note is that with only 5 mechanical complications, the study is critically underpowered, making the logistic regression coefficients unreliable for clinical threshold determination. Overall, coronal plane CT Hounsfield units independently predict mechanical complications after distal humerus open reduction and internal fixation, with only 5 complications in 153 patients, representing 3.3%. Moving on, McAnemy and colleagues published in Spine Journal, titled Paraspinal Musculature and Adjacent Segment Disease After Lumbar Fusion, a systematic review and meta-analysis of fusion with and without posterior instrumentation. This Bayesian systematic review and meta-analysis compared adjacent segment disease rates, reoperation, fusion success, and patient-reported outcome measures between standalone anterior, oblique, or lateral interbody fusion and posteriorly instrumented lumbar fusion across 27 comparative studies. Standalone fusion significantly reduced radiographic adjacent segment disease with an odds ratio of 0.51. and 95% confidence interval of 0.28 to 0.96, and adjacent segment disease-related reoperation with an odds ratio of 0.58 and 95% confidence interval of 0.33 to 0.86, with no difference in all-cause reoperation, fusion success, or perioperative complications. However, standalone fusion showed a significantly higher cage subsidence rate with an odds ratio of 1.99 and 95% confidence interval of 1.22 to 3.12, and a marginally lower Oswestry disability index at negative 1.37 points, which is below the minimal clinically important difference of 12.8. One limitation to note is that all included studies carried serious risk of bias by Robbins I criteria, meaning systematic patient selection differences between standalone and instrumented cohorts likely confound the adjacent segment disease rate comparison. Overall, standalone anterior oblique or lateral lumbar fusion without posterior instrumentation reduces radiographic adjacent segment disease odds by 49% and adjacent segment disease-related reoperation odds by 42% compared to posteriorly instrumented fusion, at the cost of a twofold increase in cage subsidence. Moving on, Heiding and colleagues published in the Journal of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, titled "A Machine Learning Approach to Determine the Optimal Age for Total Hip Arthroplasty: When is Risk for Adverse Outcomes Lowest?" Using the Pennsylvania Healthcare Cost Containment Council database from 2012 to 2018, explainable boosting machine models were trained to predict 90-day readmission at 8.0%. 90-day mortality at 0.3%, one-year revision at 1.5%, and prolonged length of stay after primary elective total hip arthroplasty. Age demonstrated a nonlinear relationship with all four outcomes. Readmission risk increased between ages 48.5 to 71.5 years. Revision risk increased below 46.5 years. Mortality risk increased after 79.5 years. And length of stay risk decreased between 52.5 to 74.5 years. The composite optimal age window for lowest adverse outcome risk was 52.5 to 71.5 years. One limitation to note is that the single state administrative database excludes functional outcomes, implant survival beyond 1 year, and surgeon or implant variables, limiting generalizability. Overall, machine learning analysis of 105,336 primary total hip arthroplasties identifies 52.5 to 71.5 years as the optimal age window for lowest composite adverse outcome risk, with revision risk rising before age 46.5 and mortality risk rising after age 79.5. Moving on, Antonoli and colleagues published in the Journal of Arthroplasty, titled "Does an isolated elevated erythrocyte sedimentation rate warrant further workup for periprosthetic joint infection after total joint arthroplasty?" This study asked whether an isolated elevated erythrocyte sedimentation rate greater than 30 millimeters per hour with normal C-reactive protein of 10 milligrams per liter or less at 90 days or more post-total joint arthroplasty warrants full periprosthetic joint infection workup. From 32,015 primary arthroplasties performed 2012 to 2023, 893 patients met criteria. Periprosthetic joint infection was subsequently diagnosed in 7 total knee arthroplasty patients at 1.1% and 3 total hip arthroplasty patients at 1.2%. After excluding cases with overt clinical findings, such as a fusion or sudden swelling, only 4 total knee arthroplasty patients at 0.5% and 1 total hip arthroplasty patient at 0.4% had occult periprosthetic joint infection detected beyond nonspecific pain. One limitation to note is that patients who did not receive further workup after an isolated elevated erythrocyte sedimentation rate were assumed infection-free based on chart review, creating verification bias. Overall, an isolated elevated erythrocyte sedimentation rate with normal C-reactive protein carries a positive predictive value of only 1.1% for total knee arthroplasty and 1.2% for total hip arthroplasty for periprosthetic joint infection. And when clinically suspicious cases are excluded, the rate of occult periprosthetic joint infection drops to 0.5 and 0.4% respectively. Moving on, Hanelin and colleagues published in the Journal of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, titled "Insurance Type Matters Most: An Analysis of Risk Factors for Poor Physical Therapy Adherence After Anterior Cruciate Ligament Reconstruction in an Urban Population." This study quantified physical therapy adherence barriers in 128 consecutive anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction patients at a single urban academic center using a 3-month postoperative questionnaire. Government-sponsored insurance independently predicted poor adherence, while area deprivation index, non-English primary language, and lack of car ownership did not. Time commitments at 58.6%, transportation at 50%, and appointment availability at 46.1% were the most frequently cited barriers. Yet 93% of patients endorsed physical therapy as necessary. One limitation to note is that the single-center urban academic cohort of only 128 patients limits generalizability to suburban, rural, or privately insured majority practices. Overall, government-sponsored insurance was the only independent risk factor for poor physical therapy adherence after anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction, with 35.9% of patients missing greater than 15% of sessions, despite 93% believing physical therapy was necessary. Moving on, Lee and colleagues published in the Journal of Shoulder and Elbow Surgery, titled Shoulder Arthroplasty Outcomes in Hypertensive Patients, a propensity score-matched comparison of ARBs and ACE inhibitors. This study asked whether perioperative angiotensin II receptor blocker versus angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitor use affects periprosthetic complication rates in hypertensive patients undergoing primary total shoulder arthroplasty. Using the TriNetX Global Collaborative Network with one-to-one propensity score matching on 8 variables, angiotensin II receptor blocker users demonstrated significantly lower rates of dislocation, periprosthetic fracture, and stiffness at 90 days, 1 year, and 2 years, with no difference in revision rates or medical complications. Subgroup analysis confirmed the periprosthetic fracture benefit for reverse total shoulder arthroplasty with an odds ratio of 0.713, and for hemiarthroplasty with an odds ratio of 0.447 at 2 years. But procedure-specific benefits were not consistent across all outcomes. One limitation to note is that the database design cannot confirm that patients actually took their medications as prescribed, and the absence of radiographic data means fracture and dislocation diagnoses depend entirely on administrative coding accuracy. Overall, angiotensin II receptor blocker use versus angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitor use in hypertensive total shoulder arthroplasty patients was associated with a 33% reduction in periprosthetic fracture risk at 2 years, with an odds ratio of 0.733, and a 33% reduction in dislocation risk at 2 years, with an odds ratio of 0.668. Moving on, Sasaki and colleagues published in the Journal of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, titled Stimulant Usage in Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder is Associated with Decreased Rates of Arthrofibrosis and Postoperative Complications Following Anterior Cruciate Ligament Reconstruction. This study used the TriNetX database to compare postoperative anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction outcomes in attention deficit hyperactivity disorder patients on stimulant medications versus those not on stimulants, with one-to-one propensity score matching on age, sex, obesity, mood disorders, anxiety, and nicotine dependence. Non-stimulant users demonstrated significantly higher rates of emergency department visits and hospital readmissions at both 3 and 6 months. At 6 months, arthrofibrosis rates were statistically significantly higher in non-stimulant users, while infection, wound disruption, revision surgery, and deep vein thrombosis rates were not significantly different. One limitation to note is that the database design cannot distinguish whether stimulant use reflects better executive function and rehabilitation adherence versus a direct pharmacologic effect on fibrosis biology. Overall, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder patients not on stimulant medications had significantly higher rates of arthrofibrosis at 6 months and increased emergency department visits and hospital readmissions at both 3 and 6 months. Post-anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction compared to stimulant users. Moving on, Weir and colleagues published in the Journal of Shoulder and Elbow Surgery, titled Operative Timing Predicts Postoperative Complications After Staged Reverse Total Shoulder Arthroplasty. This retrospective database study used the Premier Healthcare Database from 2016 to 2020 to determine whether interprocedural interval in staged bilateral reverse total shoulder arthroplasty predicts 90-day surgical complications. After propensity score matching and multivariable adjustment, staged reverse total shoulder arthroplasty at less than 6 months carried adjusted odds ratios of 2.4 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.6 to 3.6, and 6 to 12 months carried adjusted odds ratios of 1.8, with a 95% confidence interval of 1.2 to 4.8 for composite complications versus unilateral reverse total shoulder arthroplasty, driven primarily by fracture and infection. Staging beyond 12 months, with a calculated change point of 390 days, eliminated the excess risk. One limitation to note is that the 90-day observation window captures only early complications and cannot determine whether the elevated risk in short interval staging reflects physiologic deconditioning, systemic immunosuppression, or rehabilitation interference. Overall, staged bilateral reverse total shoulder arthroplasty performed within 12 months of the index procedure carries 1.8 to 2.4 times greater odds of 90-day surgical complications versus unilateral reverse total shoulder arthroplasty, with a calculated risk attenuation threshold of 390 days. Moving on, Yamada and colleagues published in Clinical Orthopedics and Related Research, titled "Diabetes is associated with higher odds of junctional complications and more reoperations after adult spinal deformity surgery, a propensity match study." This propensity-matched retrospective study asked whether diabetes increases mechanical complication risk after adult spinal deformity fusion in 557 patients treated 2010 to 2023. After 1-2 matching on age, body mass index, bone mineral density, deformity characteristics, and surgical variables, diabetic patients had odds ratio 2.5 with 95% confidence interval of 1.02 to 5.9 for proximal junctional failure, and significantly lower 2-year revision-free survivorship at 85% versus 93%. Postoperative sagittal vertical axis was greater in diabetic patients on first standing radiograph at 71 versus 54 millimeters. But health-related quality of life improvements did not differ beyond minimal clinically important difference thresholds for Oswestry Disability Index or Scoliosis Research Society 22. One limitation to note is that the single institution design with only 63 diabetic patients limits statistical power to detect differences in secondary outcomes. Overall, diabetic patients undergoing adult spinal deformity fusion had 2.5 times higher odds of proximal junctional failure at 19% versus 9% and lower 2-year revision-free survivorship at 85% versus 93% compared to propensity-matched non-diabetic controls. Moving on, Iyer and colleagues published in the American Journal of Sports Medicine, titled "Primary Arthroscopic Labral Repair in Acetabular Overcoverage: Patient-Reported Outcome Measures and Arthroplasty Rates at Midterm Follow-Up." This study compared minimum 5-year patient-reported outcome measures and total hip arthroplasty conversion rates between patients with pincer morphology defined as lateral center edge angle greater than or equal to 40 degrees, and propensity-matched non-dysplastic controls with lateral center edge angle of 25 to 40 degrees following primary hip arthroscopic labral repair. All patient-reported outcome measures, including modified Harris Hip Score, International Hip Outcome Tool 12, Hip Outcome Score, Visual Analog Score, and Tegner, were equivalent between cohorts, and patient-reported outcome measures did not differ between pincer patients with residual overcoverage versus those corrected to lateral center edge angle less than 40 degrees. Controls converted to total hip arthroplasty at nearly 3 times the rate of pincer patients at 19% versus 7%. One limitation to note is that the single-institution retrospective design with no standardized protocol for degree of rim trimming introduces surgeon-dependent variability in the extent of pincer correction. Overall, at mean 8-year follow-up, pincer morphology patients with lateral center edge angle greater than or equal to 40 degrees converted to total hip arthroplasty at 7% versus 19% in non-dysplastic controls, suggesting acetabular overcoverage may be chondroprotective. Moving on, Jolisant and colleagues published in the Journal of Arthroplasty, titled "Subsidence Starts Distally, Scaffolding versus Reconstitution Closure of the Extended Trochanteric Osteotomy in Revision Total Hip Arthroplasty," This study compared scaffolding versus reconstitution, extended trochanteric osteotomy closure techniques, and 66 revision total hip arthroplasties using tapered spline titanium stems, measuring radiographic subsidence as the primary outcome. Mean subsidence was significantly higher in the reconstitution group at 6.0 plus or minus 3.6 millimeters versus 4.3 plus or minus 2.9 millimeters, though rates of clinically significant subsidence greater than 5 millimeters were equivalent at 31.4% versus 32.3%. Distal bicortical contact greater than 30 millimeters below the extended trochanteric osteotomy was independently protective against significant subsidence with an odds ratio of 0.12. And reconstitution in healed extended trochanteric osteotomies from staged periprosthetic joint infection revisions performed comparably to scaffolding at 4.0 versus 4.3 millimeters mean subsidence. One limitation to note is that small sample size with no standardized follow-up duration limits the ability to detect differences in clinically significant subsidence rates. Overall, scaffolding extended trochanteric osteotomy closure achieves 50 millimeters of distal bicortical contact versus 28 millimeters with reconstitution, and greater than 30 millimeters distal bicortical contact below the extended trochanteric osteotomy reduces clinically significant subsidence. Moving on, Kirchner and colleagues published in Clinical Orthopedics and Related Research, titled, Is Robotic-Assisted Total Hip Arthroplasty Associated with Decreased Risk of All-Cause Revision or Revision for Dislocation? An analysis of the American Joint Replacement Registry. This American Joint Replacement Registry Medicare-linked registry study asked whether robotic-assisted total hip arthroplasty reduces all-cause revision or revision for dislocation at 2 years in Medicare-age patients 65 years or older undergoing primary elective total hip arthroplasty from 2017 to 2021. Mixed-effect Cox regression, controlling for age, Charlson comorbidity index, length of stay, sex, anesthesia type, race, surgeon, at institution, showed no difference in all-cause revision at 1.9% with robotic assistance versus 2.1% conventional, with a hazard ratio of 0.9. Revision for dislocation was significantly lower with robotic assistance at 0.3% versus 0.6% with a hazard ratio of 0.5. One limitation to note is that surgical approach, cup abduction and antiversion angles, and implant-specific data are not captured in the registry, making it impossible to confirm that the dislocation benefit is attributable to improved component positioning. Overall, robotic-assisted total hip arthroplasty was associated with a 50% reduction in revision for dislocation at 2 years with a hazard ratio of 0.5 and 95% confidence interval of 0.3 to 0.9 compared to conventional total hip arthroplasty. But no difference in all-cause revision with a hazard ratio of 0.9 and 95% confidence interval of 0.7 to 1.1. Moving on. Hoveda A. and colleagues published in the Journal of Arthroplasty, titled, Does Preoperative Air Travel Increase Infection Risk After Total Knee Arthroplasty? A Propensity-Matched Analysis. This study asked whether preoperative air travel increases infectious complications after elective primary total knee arthroplasty. Using a large administrative database, patients were classified as air versus land travelers by residence to surgery distance and propensity-matched on comorbidities. Outcomes included periprosthetic joint infection, surgical site infection, and septicemia at 30 days, 90 days, and 2 years. No significant differences were found across any infectious endpoint, with periprosthetic joint infection at 2 years of 1.0% in both groups, and septicemia rates of 0.1 to 0.2% in both cohorts. One limitation to note is that travel classification relies entirely on geographic inference from administrative data rather than confirmed travel records, meaning misclassification of both groups is probable. Overall, preoperative air travel was not associated with increased periprosthetic joint infection risk after primary total knee arthroplasty. with identical 90-day periprosthetic joint infection rates of 0.5% in both air and land travel cohorts across 23,732 propensity-matched patients. Moving on, Cordero and colleagues published in Spine Journal titled 1-2-level lateral single position surgery is highly cost-effective in the treatment of surgically indicated degenerative lumbar spinal pathology. This prospective cohort evaluated the cost utility of 1-2-level lateral single position surgery for degenerative lumbar pathology in 90 patients using EQ5D3L-derived quality-adjusted life years and comprehensive cost accounting at 2022 USD values. EQ5D3L improved from 0.55 to 0.78 with a quality-adjusted life year gain of 0.227. And Oswestry Disability Index improved from 40 to 15 to 16 at 1 to 2 years. Mean procedure cost was $27,413 USD, with device costs comprising 46% of total expenditure. Cost per quality adjusted life year fell from $104,254 at 1 year to $46,736 at 2 years, crossing the World Health Organization highly cost-effective threshold by 20 months. One limitation to note is that the single-center single-arm design without a comparator group prevents determination of whether lateral single-position surgery is more or less cost-effective than transforaminal lumbar interbody fusion, posterior lumbar interbody fusion, or decompression alone. Overall, 1-2-level lateral single-position anteroposterior fusion achieves a cost per quality-adjusted life year of $46,736 USD at 2 years, meeting the World Health Organization highly cost-effective threshold by 20 months postoperatively. And finally, Hall and colleagues published in the Journal of Arthroplasty, titled "Is Fretting Corrosion at the Modular Junction of Revision Total Knee Arthroplasty Actually a Problem?" This retrieval study asked whether fretting corrosion severity at modular stem bore junctions in revision total knee arthroplasty correlates with adverse local tissue reactions or osteolysis. 98 explanted constructs, 73 taper and 25 threaded, were graded with the modified Goldberg score and quantified via optical coordinate measuring machine. Taper junctions had significantly higher corrosion scores, with femoral bore median modified Goldberg score of 4 versus 1, with cobalt chromium femoral bore material loss of 0.56 cubic millimeters at modified Goldberg score 4. Yet corrosion severity showed no correlation with radiographic findings or indication for revision. One limitation to note is that the absence of MRI or histopathologic tissue analysis means subclinical adverse local tissue reactions cannot be excluded. Overall, taper junctions in revision total knee arthroplasty show significantly greater fretting corrosion than threaded designs at median modified Goldberg score 3-4 versus 1. But corrosion severity does not correlate with radiographic osteolysis or revision etiology. That wraps up this week's Ortho Digest Rundown, 25 studies reviewed. Head to orthodigest.com for the full write-ups.